previously on Wisco Weekly.
And we were excited to see the development of Uber. So that adds another answer. The monorail that exists in Vegas that connects to the casinos. All of those things are positives as far as we're concerned. Mm-hmm. And we think that there will be sufficient numbers to be able to justify the cost of being able to build and operate and maintain this facility. We're going to high-speed rail. Every country in the world, every first world country, has a high-speed rail system, and the Chinese showed us how to make this thing work.
And on this episode...
Over the course of 5 years or maybe 10 years, what you'll see is an explosion in transit ridership. And we've seen this in other cities as they add service, even just basic local bus service. And we're not talking amazing service. We've seen huge increases in transit ridership.
If I could summarize, because I think one of the things you had mentioned there was very key to being implement the successful transit service, and that is kind of this cultural mindset, right? Like, don't buy your kid a car at 16, wait till they're 18.
This is Wisco Weekly, an automotive business podcast sharing the voices of automakers, automotive retailers, and transportation professionals who are driving and shaping the future of automotive.
You are now tuned in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Chicken brown cow. Listeners, welcome to another episode of Wisco Weekly. I'm your host, Dennis Wisco. On the previous episode of Wisco Weekly, we have been talking about the war on cars and how sometimes, be it if it's at the city level or perhaps at the federal level, there's all these kinds of rules and regulations to essentially abolish the car. And we've even stated some cases in Europe where if it's a car that has, if it's a diesel-powered car, or if you're a non-resident in the case of Madrid, where you are banned from entering the city center. The other half of the equation, when we talk about banning cars, though, are the alternatives. And one of the events that myself and the transportation correspondent, Rudy Salo, attended a couple weeks ago was the Chapman University Future of Transportation event. And it was the fifth annual public policy conference. A lot of great speakers at this event. Certainly, as I've attended other events, I did find this one to actually be very intellectually riveting. And specifically, one of the particular panels I had the chance to attend was entitled Connecting and Paying for It All. And at this panel, they were discussing the different modes of transportation and essentially how to fund it at an infrastructure level. Some of the panelists included Jonathan English, Daryl Johnson from the OCTA, Lori Berman from Caltrans, and former governor Michael Dukakis. But on the show today, one of those panel speakers is here to share more insight into public transit, funding it, the history of it, and certainly its applications here in California, and specifically Los Angeles and Orange County. So our guest today is Jonathan English. Jonathan English is a doctoral candidate in urban planning at Columbia University. His research uses historical and other methods to examine the development of public transportation in North American suburban areas, and the effect of service levels on transit demand. He has an MA and a Master's of Science in International History from Columbia University and the London School of Economics. He has worked in government in Canada and Germany, as well as in the private sector. He also works as a consultant on transportation and infrastructure policy. His writing has been published in CityLab, Urban Omnibus, City and State New York, and other publications. Men, women, and children, please welcome to the show, Mr. Jonathan English. How are you, sir?
Great, thanks. Glad to be here.
Thank you for being on the show, and I'm certainly looking forward to being enlightened by you. I think one of the things that eventually I would like to get into, as you have written about this many times, is kind of the history, right? And let's just kind of keep it as general as the history, because I think you do this great job of mapping out the history of the automobile, mapping out the history of cities, mapping out the history of public transit, and then bringing it all together. So I think this is going to be a very enlightening conversation. You are the teacher, I am the student, so you can do what you will. However, before we begin, I guess first off, how can people follow you, Jonathan?
Well, people can certainly follow me on Twitter. It's at English Rail. So sort of a bad play on words. That's probably the best place. I'll post any articles that I write there. I've done a three-part series for City Lab. So if you just look up City Lab, Jonathan English, you'll see all the articles there. And I think I probably have another one coming in the next month or two. So yeah, as long as I get it finished. So,
okay, and listeners, I'll put his contact information or where you can follow him on Twitter on the episode page, so you can reference that. Okay, so Jonathan, I guess let's kind of start very broad based here. You're a PhD student at the moment. Maybe give us an idea of what you are currently covering in your doctoral research at the moment.
Okay, yeah. So broadly speaking, I'm looking at the relationship between transit service and transit demand. You know, really commonly when we talk about transit in North America, what we talk about is does a place have the density or the type of development to support transit? And what I'm really interested in looking at is places where the development does not kind of conventionally fit the idea of transit supportive, but where transit is nonetheless successful. So, you know, we all know that transit works well in Manhattan. It's the only way people can reasonably get around in Manhattan, or a place that looks like Manhattan. So you know, set that aside. What I'm interested in looking at is places where, you know, like suburbs, like post-war suburbs, places that look a lot like the Los Angeles area, where you got, you know, windy streets and houses with three-car garages, and yet people nevertheless choose to ride transit. So one of my main case studies is Toronto, Canada. So Toronto is a lot like, you know, a standard North American city. It grew really rapidly after the Second World War. So it's got a lot of sprawly suburbia, if you want to call it. In terms of density, its suburbs are about the same density as Los Angeles, and about 50% lower density than Santa Ana, which when I was doing research for my talk, I was amazed by how dense Santa Ana is and Orange County more generally. So what makes Toronto really interesting is that in the early 1960s, they made the basically political decision against some expert, you know, council to provide pretty decent transit service to these newly developing suburbs. So it created this kind of unintentional experiment. Toronto ran frequent buses out to these suburban areas, whereas most cities in North America, I compare to Washington and San Francisco in particular in my dissertation work, most cities in North America didn't choose to run much bus service out to those kinds of places. And lo and behold, what happened was in Toronto, people rode it. Nobody really expected it, at least not experts, because the development style was not transit friendly. But take Finch Avenue, for example. Finch Avenue is a suburban street. It developed from about the 60s to the 80s. And, you know, when you drive along that street, it's pretty much all either strip malls or the backyard fences of houses. So, you know, your standard suburban road with the backyard fence of houses.
How many lanes approximately?
It's four most of the way and six in parts.
Okay.
You know, but with turning lanes and all that stuff at the major intersections, it's a big suburban road. And so you've got, you know, a few shopping malls and some apartments, but in general, it's classic suburbia. And yet, it has one of the busiest bus routes in North America. So busier than all but a few bus routes in Manhattan, basically in the U.S., and one or two in Brooklyn. And you know, how is that possible? Well, so this bus route runs up to every 60 seconds in the peak, and no worse than every couple minutes all day long, and it runs 24 hours a day. So no one, absolutely no expert would ever say, you know, take a look at a street like Finch, its density, its development, and say you should run a frequent bus on that route. They would say maybe a bus every hour in the U.S. But my argument is that because they made the decision to provide much more frequent service on that route, that the riders showed up. And so my basic sort of catchphrase, if you want to call it that, is that, you know, if you build it, they might come. But if you don't, they definitely won't. what I mean by that is that demand is never going to materialize unless you provide the service. If you open up a store and it's not busy at first, but you only leave the store open for 2 hours a day, 3 days a week or something like that, nobody's going to shop at that store. It's never going to get busy. So you're never going to be able to, quote unquote, justify adding more hours or, you know, expanding the store or whatever it might be. It's the same thing. If you're running the bus every 73 minutes and you stop running at 6 p.m., which is very typical in American suburbia, the riders are never going to show up. Nobody is going to ride that bus unless they absolutely have no choice. And because of that, you're never going to be able to justify the service improvements that, you know, through the demand that has shown itself. And what we've seen in the U.S. is that a lot of people have suggested the way to sort of jumpstart things and to get around this is, okay, we'll build a light rail line. And we'll spend a lot of money on this light rail line. The problem is that there's no connecting network. So people can't get to the light rail line unless they happen to live and, you know, work or wherever they're going right next to that light rail line. So what I'd argue is in many cases, this is putting the cart before the horse. It's much better to have a frequent bus within a reasonable walking distance of everybody or nearly everybody in the region. And then later you can improve the service by upgrading the busiest routes to rail or creating a fast crosstown service with rail. And incidentally, improving bus service, you know, building a whole light rail network can cost billions, but building, you know, just improving bus service, you don't have to build anything. We're talking billions for the light rail, but improving bus service can only be, you know, it might be as little as a few million dollars a year to really make a big dent in improving service quality. So, you know, when we're talking about the cost of transit, this is a big way of making meaningful improvements quickly and also without spending billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about the bus specifically. What do you know, how many passengers, how modern or how old? Give me a better idea of that the buses that are being used.
Oh, you're talking about in Toronto? The Finch?
Yes.
On Finch, the bus is a very typical standard bus, basically the same type of bus that you'd see in any American city. They're 40-foot or, on Finch, they use some 60-foot, the bendy buses. They look pretty normal. They're not more comfortable than a typical bus, although okay. Should be. Before I go on, the transit service in Toronto is far from perfect. There are certainly things that could be improved, but it just goes to show that even when things aren't perfect, you can attract a lot of riders if the service is frequent. And one of the other things, one of the reasons that the bus is successful is that, in a lot of the U.S., you know, middle class people, let's say, they don't know any, they've never ridden the bus. They don't know anybody who rides the bus. And so because of that, the bus has this mysterious and maybe a little bit scary quality. You know, people think it's a dodgy way to get around. In Toronto, if people haven't ridden the bus themselves, they certainly know friends who have, or they did when they were younger, or whatever it might be. So it's a much less intimidating environment. So a combination of, you get a virtuous cycle of, you know, when more people ride the bus, more people are comfortable with riding the bus. And that's, you know, to go back into the history of it, that's sort of the exact opposite of what happened and why transit declined in the U.S. And I talked about that in one of my CityLab articles. So, you know, in the post-war years, people started buying cars. People, you know, the federal government in the 50s started funding expressways. So the car became a very attractive way to get around. And there's no question the car transformed cities in many ways for the better. You know, it allowed people to get out of really crowded urban conditions that we can't even imagine today. You know, the Lower East Side in New York is a fashionable and fun and exciting place to live today. It was not fashionable, fun, and exciting when there were seven people living in a one-room apartment. Might have been exciting, but maybe not. what happened was people suddenly could afford to buy cars. They could afford, and because they could travel so much further with their car, they could live on cheaper land further out. So that was sort of the birth of the modern suburb. And, you know, it's not surprising that happened. And what transit companies, in many cases, because in those days people saw transit as a profit-making business, even when it was owned by the city, which it was in some cases, the city still expected transit to break even or even make a profit. So what happened, and this, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens in many companies, as revenue started to drop because of changing technology, these companies were left with one option. In order to balance the budget, they had to cut the service, so their expenditure. The problem is, you know, it's just the same as when you start, you know, closing stores or cheaping out on you know, the free bread at the restaurant or whatever it might be. Whenever you cut service to try and balance the budget, you end up driving customers and therefore revenue away. And that's exactly what happened across the United States. Riders started to disappear.
Are we still talking about the 1950s, 60s? The
50s and 60s, yeah.
Okay.
Riders started to disappear as they bought cars, and then service was cut to balance the budget, and now suddenly the bus or the streetcar or whatever it might have been that came every 5 minutes is coming every 25 minutes. And people are saying, even if they didn't want to buy the car in the first place, they're saying, well, forget it. I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy the car. And because of that, you ended up with this huge vicious cycle. So, you know, take a city like Cleveland, for example. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but the proportions roughly. Cleveland in 1946, which was the peak year for American transit, because during the war, rationing meant you couldn't drive. In 1946, Cleveland moved around 450 million riders a year, which is a lot. Within 20 years, they were only moving around 70 million a year. So the ridership just melted away. And the second reason why it melted is service was cut in the existing areas. But people were moving in huge numbers out to these newly developed areas, where in many cases, no transit or next to no transit was even provided at all. So Toronto, there were two fundamental differences when Toronto took a different path in the early 60s. Firstly, Toronto decided that they needed to provide a very, very small amount of subsidy. It really was quite small at the time, so that they didn't have to jack up fares and cut service radically. And secondly, they decided, and it was a political choice because Toronto had a metropolitan government, so suburban politicians had a lot of control over the transit system, they decided to expand service to these newly developed suburban areas. And people said, oh, it's going to require so much subsidy, it's going to be a disaster. But in fact, now the suburban buses have a better fare performance. So they get more of their operating cost from fares than the downtown routes. And also, Toronto has the highest fare recovery. So it requires the least subsidy as a percentage of
any. I'm sorry. Explain. It has the highest fare recovery.
So fare recovery is just sort of a term that's used in transit, in the transit world, which means the percentage of your costs that you recover from the fare.
Understood.
So for example, in New York, around 50% of the cost of running the subways and buses in New York come from the money people put in the fare box. In Toronto, it's over 70%. In a lot of sort of smaller American systems, we're talking, in the teens.
Yeah, right.
It's really, really, really low. Because, of course, the buses, are pretty much just an emergency type of service for people who have no other option. You know, in Toronto, everybody from the low-income people to high-income people use transit, so the buses are full. And a full bus obviously is going to be more efficient than a bus where only people who cannot afford a car. And the reality is, I was just in Los Angeles, for this conference, and I noticed that they had gas for $5 a gallon. And I couldn't believe that this was in the United States, that gas was $5 a gallon. And yet, the highways were still pretty busy because this idea that high gas prices are going to drive people to transit is a complete mistake, because if the service isn't there, people are just going to eat the cost of gas. If transit is not a viable option, people aren't going to use it, even if you make it harder or more expensive to drive.
Well, so I feel like I've heard from Jonathan English, the doctoral candidate here, the researcher. However, if I can put you now in a position of saying, okay, now you're Jonathan English, the mayor, you're Jonathan English, the venture capitalist. Mm-hmm. How would you now start to look at areas of Los Angeles and Orange County and say, well, look, you guys gave up on transit 50 years ago, again, you're the optimist here. You're the mayor, you're the venture capitalist. So of course you see an opportunity in this. Where can Los Angeles and Orange County improve transit services, given the fact that based on the history, they cut a lot of these services, they don't have as many frequent transit services available to its citizens? How would you look to fix these two areas, and maybe not even just Los Angeles, Orange County, maybe we could just look at Southern California as a whole?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's always wonderful to talk about what could happen in the future. And yeah, in fact, I find it exciting. In many ways, Los Angeles, contrary to popular belief, is a lot more transit friendly than a lot of cities in the United States, or at least potentially so, because A, the density is actually relatively high, and B, you don't have these East Coast, on the East Coast, you have a lot of these suburbs where you've got, one street of houses surrounded by a bunch of trees, and it's a lot more spread out. Whereas in LA, the suburbs and Orange County, the suburbs are actually relatively compact. So that said, what I would say is you have to think about the sort of six pillars, I call them, of successful transit. You have to think about all of these different things that come together to make a successful transit system. So firstly, you have to think about the frequency. How frequently are these bus routes coming? If a bus route is coming every hour, nobody with a choice is going to ride it. If it's going to come every half hour, maybe, people might start to think about it. If a bus route is coming every 10 minutes, research has shown that people, they don't have to look at the schedule. they don't have to worry when they're making a connection. If they miss it, the next one's along in 10 minutes. It's not the end of the world. So 10 minutes, 12 minutes is kind of a magic number for frequency. Then there's coverage. You know, does the bus network, does the transit network allow you to get everywhere you want to go? If you have four or five regular trips, work, shopping, friend's house, parents' house, whatever, if even one of those you can't get to by transit, you're going to go out and buy a car. And once you have the car, or, you know, the second car or the third car, and once you have it, you're going to want to use it because you're paying for it anyway. A gas is only a small percentage of the price of owning a car. So the coverage is quite important. And we're seeing a lot of transit systems cutting back coverage of suburban areas. And I think that in many cases, you know, sometimes it's unavoidable, and I know that resources are limited, but in many cases, it's a bit of a mistake because if you're only providing transit service in a very limited area, you're only going to be able to serve a limited percentage of the population, and that's what we need to get away from.
And I think that's going to be pretty challenging in a sprawling area of Los Angeles. To provide some kind of successful coverage that would accommodate somebody living who wants to go from Burbank all the way to the west side of Santa Monica.
Well, in some ways, Burbank to Santa Monica absolutely is an area that could be well served by transit. You know, somewhere out in the furthest edge of the Inland Empire or something to I don't know, South County, Orange County or something, that would be challenging. But the entire area from Burbank to Santa Monica is heavily developed. And that's true of the whole valley and northern part of Orange County and the city of Los Angeles itself. So in many ways, you know, Toronto's managed to make it work. Toronto's population's, the city of Toronto is a bit smaller than the city of Los Angeles. And the density, at least of the suburban areas, is similar. When you count that some of Los Angeles is forest, it's quite similar. Forest and mountains or whatever. And so really these two places aren't that different. You know, the other pillars I'll go through quickly, frequency and coverage, I said, then you have fares. You know, do you have to pay for a transfer, for example? If you do, you shouldn't, because the transfer is an inconvenience. You shouldn't have to pay more for it. You know, do you have to pay a huge fare penalty when you cross the boundary of a municipality? You know, that's quite punitive. Or to transfer between modes, bus to subway or whatever, you shouldn't. Los Angeles's fares are actually quite low, so that's not a huge issue. Span of service. This is one that's often forgotten. You often see service frequency improve, but the last bus still leaves at 9 p.m. Well, restaurants don't close at 9 p.m. People don't leave their friends' houses at 9 p.m. A lot of workplaces don't close at 9 p.m. You know, the mall closes at 9, but if you work there, you know, you're not leaving for a while after that. So, that makes transit useless for a lot of people. And then, you know, speed. Is it quick? Even if a local bus is slow, can you connect to an express bus or a rail service that's faster so you can go long distances?
And so the speed is only specific to the velocity of the bus in this case. It's not necessarily the speed to get your fare, get onto the bus.
No. The what you said the second time, that's what really matters. How long does it take from your house to your destination?
Yes, yes.
And in fact, how much time do you have to budget? So, for example, if it's always delayed, or if, you know, the bus is so infrequent that if you miss your connection, you have to wait a half an hour, you have to budget a lot more time than if the bus comes every couple minutes, and so you don't have to worry about your connection. So even if you don't actually speed the bus itself, you can make your trip much shorter by making the connection quicker and easier, making it so you don't have to wait nearly as long as at the stop, and potentially making it so you don't have to walk as far to the stop.
Just a quick digression on that one. I mean, I experienced exactly that as I was en route to the Future of Transportation event, where I had all the intentions to take the train that is nearby me. It's about maybe a 10-minute drive to the Laguna Niguel station and take it up to the Orange station. And one of the things I did not account for was the fact that parking at the Laguna Niguel station, A, was packed, but B, I had to park so far down that it probably took me about a good 10-minute walk to get to the station. Now, in that process, so I think the train left at 9:10 or 9:15 or something like that. And I think I got there about 9 o'clock, you know, thinking that, okay, that's plenty of time, park, and I got 5 minutes I can hang out. That's plenty of time. Well, because I had to find parking, because I had to walk, as I'm now literally walking to the station, the train is going by me. And then, you know, to one of your other pillars, like as I looked at what time the next train leaves, the next train left at like, you know, close to 11 o'clock, which would have meant I would have missed the start of the event. So I empathize, you know, to these pillars and definitely the speed of being able to get onto these transit services is paramount. And part of that is my fault in just not knowing how that works.
But it, you know, it shouldn't be your fault because it should be easy. And this actually comes to another way that Toronto has had quite a lot of success. You know, and I just want to make clear again, you know, Toronto is not a transit oriented development paradise or anything like that. And it does not have the perfect transit system. It's just done a few things right. And that pays huge dividends. So when you compare it to San Francisco, so BART, they really planned it around the idea that people would park and ride. The problem with park and ride is that a subway can carry, 30,000, even 40,000 people an hour. There is absolutely no way that you could provide enough parking spaces to come anywhere near close to filling a subway line. It's just not possible. You'd have to have a Disneyland parking garage at every station. So what Toronto does is it extends the catchment area through connecting buses. Because the bus is frequent enough, people take the bus to the subway, and then they can take the subway to go on their longer distance trip. And, you know, there are still some parking spaces, but those lots aren't full because most people find it easier to just leave the car in the driveway, take the bus, you know, at the end of the block, and take the bus to the subway, which pulls right into the station. And coming the other way, there's a convenient, warm, covered waiting area, which in your climate may be less important, but in our climate matters.
We don't have those conversations over here.
Yeah, no, that's another thing. So, I mean, to come back to your question, what ultimately I would say would be the ideal.
Wait. I'm sorry. Before you answer that question, I don't want to give away the punchline. So you did mention six pillars, but you've stated five: frequency, coverage, fares, span of service, speed. What's the last pillar?
Frequency, coverage, fares, span of service, speed, and connectivity. So can you connect easily from bus to train, from bus to bus as well? So, you know, if you're going from some place on a bus to another place on a bus, in theory, and there's an Australian academic who unfortunately passed away, but his name is Paul Mees, and he's written really, really well on this stuff. He talked about Toronto and Melbourne, Australia, and some other cities as well in Europe. He calls it the network effect. So if your buses run frequently enough, people don't mind the idea of switching from one bus to another. If the buses come every hour, nobody wants to stand on a suburban street corner for 45 minutes waiting for the next bus. If they come every 10 minutes, you can connect from bus to bus. And now suddenly you can get anywhere you want because it's a grid, right? You just go this way and then you go that way. It really maximizes the way that you can get around even without having to say go downtown and make your connection there, which is how a lot of transit systems work these days. But yeah, so in terms of a kind of long-term vision for the LA area, you know, in some ways the vision sounds ambitious, but in another way it would cost in probably a fraction of what some of these big rail projects would cost. And that is to develop a simple service standard that says that every single person, or let's say 90% of people, because obviously there are people that live up in the hills and that would be pretty difficult. But everybody that lives in a relatively developed area would be within a 10 or 15 minute walk of a bus that comes every 10 to 15 minutes all day. And, you know, you could do that by, you know, Los Angeles, most of the streets are a grid. So for each of the big streets, let's say maybe about a mile apart, you have an absolute policy that the bus on those streets will come every 10 to 15 minutes. And you don't have to check a schedule. You know that it will come that frequently. And that it will come every, even 24 hours a day. Now, obviously, you might have lower frequency at 2 a.m., but in general, all day into the night, that level of frequency. So that means that now everybody is within a reasonable walking distance of frequent, reliable transit. It might not be the fastest, it might not be the most comfortable in the world, but it's there and it's an option. So if they're going from their house to a mall down the road or whatever it might be, that bus is very useful. If they want to go from Burbank to Santa Monica, they can take the bus to the train and then take the train to Santa Monica. So that's a viable option. The second part, which I suggested, is, big rail projects, especially subways, are very, very expensive. LA's built some and it's building more, and tunneling especially adds a lot of cost. One idea is to use the existing rail corridors that Metrolink uses. You mentioned the train to Orange from Laguna Niguel. Use those lines, but just run them more frequently. Run them more like a transit service rather than like a commuter service. So they also should come maybe every 15 minutes. So you can turn up and go like you do on the metro, rather than having to constantly consult a schedule. Now, that dramatically increases the mileage of rapid transit without having to dig tunnels or build new stations or any of that really expensive stuff. Now, I know that there are issues. Some of those lines are owned by the freight railways, and if that's true, you have to negotiate with them. You know, you might even have to try and buy out a parallel, a strip of land along that corridor to build your own tracks. But it's still going to be a lot cheaper than digging tunnels. And in fact, one of the things that sort of struck me, and I talked to some people here, is that I genuinely believe that if Los Angeles did that, the bus service improvements, not day one, not year one necessarily, because it takes time for people to change their mentality, to not buy the third car, to not buy the kids the car the day they turn 16, to even just consider riding transit. It takes time, but, over the course of 5 years or maybe 10 years, what you'll see is an explosion in transit ridership. And we've seen this in other cities as they add service, even just basic local bus service. And we're not talking amazing service. We've seen huge increases in transit ridership.
If I could summarize, and because I think one of the things you had mentioned there was very key to being implement the successful transit service, and that is kind of this cultural mindset, right? Like, don't buy your kid a car at 16, wait till they're 18. Don't expect the results at 1 year, expect it at 5 years, because part of where, as you're painting this picture, one of the things I'm thinking about was, well, okay, so for instance, let's just say the Orange County or LA County starts to implement a bus service that does have more frequency. Well, the other challenge, though, is the fact that going from a mile-to-mile stop is still going to take a significant amount of time because you still have cars on the road. Mm-hmm. So then I'm looking at it from a perspective of, okay, well, if I'm in charge of OCTA or LA DOT, what what's the cost to me to be able to continue to provide those services? And then essentially, how can I continue to fund that? But I do like the fact that this is this kind of five-year outlook or commitment. This is a cultural element that we must change. And only at the five-year mark can we really say, hey, this was successful to take this risk and say, you know what, we implemented the five or the six pillars that Jonathan had said. And while it wasn't successful year one, by year four, wow, the ridership did increase. So it's really a long play.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have to change the culture. I mean, Los Angeles is the car city. I've been spending a lot of time in the archives, in Toronto, and looking at what people were saying in the 1950s. And the hilarious thing is that they're talking about Los Angeles. And the local politician who really pushed transit improvements kept telling jokes about Los Angeles, the car city. And you have to remember that in the 1950s, Los Angeles was kind of the epitome of modernity. It was the ideal that cities were aspiring to. But he had all these jokes about, you know, how they've built miles and miles and miles of expressways. And so you can have an expressway everywhere. But his joke, it's not the world's best joke, but was you had to have you had to tow a trailer behind your car because you needed a place to live while you looked for parking. And it's really true.
Yeah, so true.
Los Angeles, and I noticed it, you know, when I was living, when I was visiting Los Angeles, it's really hard to find parking. Mm-hmm. And parking lots are packed. And look, we're never going to get rid of the car, especially in a city like Los Angeles. That's never going to happen. What you need to think in terms of is, as the city is growing, they just can't build more expressways. So new demand has to be served somehow. And can we convince some of the people who, you know, I went down to San Diego to visit some friends when I was in Los Angeles and I wanted to take the train. The problem was the fare was too high. It would have cost me $80 round trip. And I was going with a friend, so 160. And
where was the starting point?
Los Angeles.
Okay.
Union Station. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it was not very frequent, so I would have had to schedule my day around all that. The schedule, which was inconvenient. So I drove, and I was another car contributing to the three-hour slowdown on I-5 down to San Diego. I didn't want to be. You know, this is the point. This isn't about forcing people out of their cars. It's about giving people who don't want to be in their car an option.
Yeah, right.
And that's, and that's what's so frustrating about it. It's not, people are talking about, abolishing the car or getting 100% of people on transit. Let's try just getting 25% of people on transit.
Well, and I think the other thing, too, is the whole idea of abolishing the car. It's looked at very much as a punitive thing, right?
Yeah,
like exactly. Your car is dirty. It's congesting traffic. It's doing all these things. So get out of it and start doing, public transit or do some form of transit ridership. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's too easy.
Yeah.
You know, for as much as it's a pain to get my car, it's still easier than taking the train from LA to San Diego. I have a few more questions here for you. So, a lot of ways you've depicted the bus to be the solution, especially as it's applied to the city of Toronto, which is the case study that you mentioned. Are there other, or what are the other recommended forms of transit that could still adhere to those six pillars of great transit?
Well, the way that I see the bus is the bus is the foundation. The basic local bus is your foundation. Now, you can't have a good house without a good foundation. Of course, you can't have a very good house without, walls and a roof and, nice decorations either. So you got to get the foundation right. But then there are other things that you need to do to make transit genuinely attractive. So, for example, Do you offer a express service or a fast rail service that gets you across town quickly, especially in a place as big as LA? If you're talking about, I don't know, Fresno or something, you know, the distances aren't as huge, but LA is enormous. You can't just take a local bus from Santa Monica to, you know, San Bernardino or something. So, you know, that's where things like rail come in. That's where things like express buses, maybe on freeways using the diamond lanes, something like that, you know, those come in. You know, there are also things that are coming around, new technologies. I think in many ways that these are being used as a bit of a crutch for transit systems that want to kind of provide the bare minimum service. You're seeing a lot of these on-demand experiments, and you know, there's nothing wrong with experimenting in it. And for certain types of places, on-demand service might make sense, where you hail it with an app. But the reality is it doesn't scale very well. As soon as you start having large numbers of people use this service, the cost of drivers becomes, or even just the cost of vehicles becomes enormous, and they end up, you know, they might cut down a little bit on traffic because you've got a couple people in the car, but not nearly as much. And, you know, these things are so expensive to provide that most of the examples we've seen, you know, we're talking about, you know, I believe the speaker before me or after me on the panel from Orange County said they
Darryl
were
Johnson.
They were providing an on-demand service, and but the figure, I don't remember it offhand, so I don't want to say it, but it was in, you know, the tens of thousands a range over the course of 6 months. So compare that to the Finch bus in Toronto running through a suburban area. It serves the Finch West 50,000 a day. So
Is micro mobility common in Toronto's transit system?
No.
No. What are your thoughts of micro mobility being able to help accommodate the, you know, specifically the connectivity pillar?
Yeah. So, you know, I think the problem with it, as I mentioned, is that it doesn't scale well. But you know, absolutely, there are cases where, you know, you've got a really an outer suburb, maybe to get to the commuter rail station or to get into that one suburb that's kind of far from the main street or something like that. Absolutely, it makes a lot of sense to have, you know, it doesn't always make sense to have a 40-foot bus driving down every winding little street, for sure. There's definitely a place for on-demand. And, you know, and it's a reality that we are seeing people doing things like taking Uber or Lyft to the subway station or taking it to the busier bus route if they don't want to walk as far, or taking the bus one way to the store and then Uber back because they've got a lot of bags. You know, these kinds of things are happening. But ultimately, in the big picture, especially when you're talking about a place as big and actually, you know, unexpectedly as dense as Los Angeles, you can't move the kinds of people that we're talking using. Because Los Angeles is not a micro city. It's a very macro city. It's a huge place. So,
A few more questions here then. So I'm curious on your thoughts on a few different transportation projects that are currently in existence. So, for instance, quickly here, tell me, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, and why Hyperloop One?
Well, I think Hyperloop, you know, it's an interesting idea, but in many cases we gotta walk before we can run. We don't have the basics of a transportation system down. You know, we haven't been able to master, you know, conventional high-speed rail technology, which is 50-year-old technology, much of which, I might add, was developed in the United States, although never successfully implemented here. A lot of the technology that the Japanese and the French took was developed in the U.S., just never implemented here. If we haven't been able to manage to implement a proven half-century-old technology, it's hard to convince me that a brand new, completely untested, completely untried technology is the way to go. You know, walk before you can run.
That's actually very astute. Have never heard the criticism of Hyperloop One expressed in that way. So thank you for that. How about Elon Musk's tunnel system?
Well, I mean, it's certainly interesting that he's managed to tunnel at a relatively low cost. The problem again here is that it does not scale well. You know, he's talking about, you know, putting cars in elevators and sending the car down into the tunnel and shooting the cars through the tunnel. So that's nice for a few people that are going to be able to be in their cars on that. But look at the size of the 405. You know, this is, we're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of cars, you know, hundreds of thousands of cars a day. You're not going to be able to fit hundreds of thousands of cars a day, you know, in an elevator and going down one tunnel like that. There's a reason that the train, you know, the subway train, you know, was invented. And there's a reason that the technology is still going strong, you know, over 100 years later. And that is that it's a hell of a lot more efficient to pack 250 people into one vehicle than it is to pack one or two people in one vehicle with four wheels. So, you know, again, in a small place, these things aren't a problem. In a place with 15 million people like Los Angeles, it doesn't scale to make a meaningful dent in traffic. It's more like an expensive Lexus lane, the fast track lanes.
Yeah, okay. Las Vegas high-speed rail.
I think there's a lot of potential. You know, California is well-suited to high-speed rail. The highways are busy. The corridors are relatively direct. You know, everyone knows where a lot of the trips are going. Los Angeles to Las Vegas is one of the busiest flight routes in the country. I think there's a lot of potential there. It should also be relatively cheap because the land in between LA and Las Vegas is not heavily developed. You know, very different from the East Coast. I mean, LA is developed, but most of that distance is desert. So building it shouldn't be nearly as hard as say building from New York to Washington or something like that. I think it has a lot of potential. And I think that people underestimate how much high-speed rail can really psychologically change the way that people relate between cities, and it can be in a very positive way. You know, in France,
on that. Yeah.
Yeah, when they opened the high-speed line from Paris to Lyon, suddenly Lyon was within an hour and a half of Paris, whereas it previously had been hours by car or by regular train. Suddenly people decided Lyon was it's considered the culinary capital of France. So a lot of Parisians said, okay, why don't we just go down for dinner in Lyon? And Lyon was a city that had, its economy was relatively strong, but some other cities that have experienced this phenomenon, the economy was not so strong. And, people were able to, you know, go have dinner and then come back the same evening. With high-speed rail, you can't do this by air because of the stress at the airport. You can't do it by car because it's just too far. But by high-speed rail, it's quite realistic that you could go see a show in Las Vegas or whatever at night, or, you know, for an evening, go for dinner, and then come back the same evening. So it really can enhance people's lives and options. And, you don't necessarily want people making those kinds of trips all the time. But especially for places that have maybe lower performing economies, for example, being connected to a big city so people can go there more easily is quite good for the economy.
Excellent. Well, Jonathan, so what's on tap for you for at least maybe the rest of this year?
Well, I'm finishing writing up this dissertation, and so hopefully...
When are you expected to defend your thesis and claim your PhD?
Hopefully by the end of the year. So,
excellent.
Fingers crossed. Okay. And I'm writing a little bit more. I'm writing for CityLab another article, and I'm hoping to write an article a little bit talking about construction costs, which was something we didn't talk about today, but we talked about a bit on the panel. You know, the U.S. has the highest transit infrastructure construction costs in the world. And so the U.S. is getting much less bang for the buck on transit, the money being spent, than places like France or Spain or Germany or Japan, let alone, you know, places like China or whatever. But that's a bit of a different story.
Well, I hope actually, Jonathan, that we do this again to talk about construction costs. And so maybe just as a personal update, you can let us know more about where you're at with your PhD. So perhaps we can get together later this year.
That would be
and rehash everything. Yeah,
that would be great. Thanks very much.
Well, great. Jonathan, I sincerely appreciate you being on WSCO Weekly and dropping all your knowledge and sharing all your dissertation research with us. Certainly those six pillars of great transit, I hope that more people involved in city and federal governments around here specifically, since it affects me, take heed to your advice and to your research. So listeners, don't forget that I will put his information on the episode page. Please do follow him and continue to learn more about some of the great work that Jonathan is doing. On behalf of Kelly, Rudy, and myself, cheers, prost, lachaim, kipis, nastravi, salut, kampai, mabruk, tutsins, gambe, yamas, to the customer experience.